Welcome to Dysfunctional Podcast. I am Jesus at Dysfunctional of Dysfunctional.com. Dysfunctional Podcast is now on iTunes. You can search us by going to iTunes and searching Dysfunctional, T-H-I-S-F-U-N-K-T-I-O-N-A-L. Today's podcast consists of audio from the press day for Arrival. In Arrival, a linguist is recruited by the military to assist in translating alien communications. At the press day, we got a chance to talk with screenwriter Eric Heiser, producers Dan Levine, David Lind, and Aaron Ryder. First up, we have Dan Levine.
How's everyone?
Good.
Excellent.
Congratulations on the movie.
Thank you. So you've all seen it?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Good?
Yes.
Good. You're still here? That's good?
Yeah. So this all started when, and Eric brought it to you, right? His spec script? Or how did
No,
this
how it started is, I'm a producer, but I'm also the president of 21 Labs, which is Sean Levy's company. And we had a meeting with Eric Heiser, who's a writer we really admired. He was mostly writing horror at the time. And we spent 2 hours with him trying to find ideas, and he said no to everything. But on his way out, I said to him, is there anything you like? And he says, well, you know, there's this book of short stories by this unknown sci-fi writer named Ted Chaney you should check out. And I had never heard of Ted. And we read the book, and Story of Your Life, which is what the original title was, just, it was a jaw-dropper. It was the most amazing short story, not just emotionally, like you could see in the film, just a bombshell. I was just sweating and going, I hope this is available. I hope no one has the rights to this. But so, yes, we found the short story because Eric brought it to us. He was always attached to write it. Mm-hmm.
What was your reaction when you first read his script, what he did with the
Well,
script?
You know, we developed many, many drafts with him, and it took a long time. It's a very complicated short story, and the script's very complicated. And it changed quite a bit. But the draft, we probably did 20 drafts before we showed it to anyone. And so I just remember the opening scenes were so deeply moving. I knew we were on the right path. But I was just so impressed with Eric because we would always, with any script, you hit a roadblock creatively. And you think, how do we get past this? We're doomed. And he'd always bolt up off the couch and be, I got it. And, you know, he just always knew how to break through any creative wall we had. And it was a great partnership with him.
Okay, I'll ask the question.
Yeah,
you're right. Like I was going to say. So throughout the whole thing, I probably wasn't the only one. It's like, what is this about exactly? When you read the script, did it ever baffle you a bit, trying to figure out the splash forward or the concept of it all?
Yeah, without speaking to the twist, I would just say that I knew what the bones of the story was. I mean,
oh, so you knew that.
Yeah, from the short story. The difference with the short story and script, among many things, but the one thing it has in common is the mother-daughter storyline, that emotional reveal, that emotion, and it also has aliens landing on our planet, but in the story, there are many ships, they're not even ships, they're little crafts with no aliens on them, so it's a very different story, but having built it from the ground up with Eric, I never was confused. My job was to make sure other people weren't confused.
Okay, fair enough.
What were some of the things from the story some themes that you wanted to extract or expand upon?
I think the main was, is it better to have loved and lost than to never loved at all? That was what was driving us the entire time. And that was the thing that, we had that emotional storyline. What we didn't have were the stakes, the tension, the dread, the feeling that this could happen. There was a lot that we had to construct around it, but that story was there. And that was always the beating heart of the movie.
You know, it seems like there are so many sources for material out there. People are getting their stories out there in so many different ways, whether that be like viral videos or just anything. So as a producer, do you have to comb through like much more sources nowadays to kind of find material that might be viable?
I've always operated that way. I think if you sit back as a producer and wait for things to come your way, they never do. So you have to look at everything. I find incredibly rewarding, and it happened in this case, is find writers you love, sit down with them, and if you really connect with them, talk about what you love. What have they read? What have we read? Sometimes, like this, you find it in the first meeting. Sometimes it takes 3 years of emails back and forth and phone calls back and forth. But you do have to look at articles, books, plays, scripts, remakes, old obscure films, ideas that you've had, ideas that writers have. So you have to throw a wide net out there because the days of scripts just showing up on your desk are over.
With
we're in like the studio system, all the like things, big blockbusters are mostly IP related and driven. What inspires you to take a risk on something that isn't, you know, a superhero thing or like something that...
As much as I would love to have a big, fat superhero movie that the whole world knows about, I love the challenge. I love finding that thing that no one's seen before. I'd love to find that diamond in the rough. Like, this couldn't have been a more exciting story. I mean, this is over 5.5 years ago that I sat with Eric and a colleague of mine, Dan Cohen, and we had that meeting, and that was exciting. That was very exciting to be able to find this short story, and then it was exciting trying to find Ted Chiang, because he had no agent, he had no lawyer, he had a day job. He was an obscure sci-fi writer, although everything he had written got awards, or won awards, and so tracking him down, that's the, to me, it's the mystery and the hunt.
And what was his association with the production of it? Like, did he... Was he a part of it?
You know, we always kept him in the loop because we were so thankful for the material he created. You know, he came to set, we showed him scripts. It's not that, you know, he didn't help write the script. It wasn't his medium, and he knew that. But we kept him involved just because we would love seeing his wonder and awe of what we were creating off of his idea.
You seem to be very involved in the story building aspect of this. And I know, like, obviously some of the locations like China and Russia are picked for storytelling reasons. Why? What made Montana the right location for the U.S.? Because I couldn't help but think, like, in the Star Trek universe, Montana is where they make first contact as well. So I didn't
Interesting.
Know
I did not know that. I believe it was in the book, but we liked the idea. What we wanted to avoid in the movie was the ships landing around iconic buildings like the Eiffel Tower and the White House, and we wanted to actually have them show up in mysterious places that you couldn't understand why they were there. We also really liked the idea of not always answering everything in the movie, and obviously not being confusing, but we like people to wonder. We had so many conversations about, well, where should they land? Should I make a pattern when you pull out and look at it? Is it random? Is it... And we just kind of... Montana, we like the idea that it just parked in the middle of nowhere. The flat plateau, that Stark ship just sitting on top of this land, and us having to come to them.
So what do you think, Dennis was the perfect man for the job?
It's interesting. When we first met Eric, and he told us about the short story, and while we had finally found Ted Chiang, and we were in a long conversation with him about allowing us to have the rights, and he wasn't sure. He was very skeptical, and I will get to answering your question. But... it's crazy how it happened, but we also then just, maybe weeks later, just as we were in the middle of the conversations with Ted, we met with Denis off his film he did called Ensemble Days, which is a phenomenal film, and it showed he was a master at pointing you at, thinking you're going in one direction and revealing something else. And we just were desperate to be in business with him, and when we sat down with him, he said, I've been dreaming of doing sci-fi since I was 10 years old. And we said, well, you know, we just read this story. We don't have the rights, don't tell anyone about it, but here it is. Let us try to get the rights. In the meantime, we went back to Ted, and Ted's like, I don't know if I'll give you the rights. What if it's not a good movie? How do I know you'll get a good director? And we said, well, we don't know if we can get him, but check this movie out. This is the kind of guy we'd want. And he watched and he said yes, and then Denis came back to us and said, I love it, but I'm going off to do Prisoners. I just don't know how to crack it right now. We said, do Prisoners. Let us work on it for, you know, a year, and when you're done, we'll have a script for you. And that's what happened, which is, it never happens that way. Usually something goes terribly wrong along the way.
You talked a little bit about trying something different. You know, it's not superhero, it's the kind of new story. But your cast are no stranger to, like, superhero things and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about getting them on board?
By the way, you'll notice that everybody's in a superhero movie. It's impossible. As a producer, the hardest thing to do now is cast movies because they're all committed. Yeah. And there's multiple sequels, and those movies are doing incredibly well. So it's always, every producer is ripping their hair out because it's scheduling. They're all in those movies. But I remember we flew up to Montreal to see Denis to talk about cast, really just about who would be Louise. And we just had one name, and he had one name, and it was Amy. And the amazing thing about that is we had just heard that she was going to take time off, that she had been working back to back to back and needed a break. But her agent was really supportive, and we gave her the script, and literally in a week, usually these things take months, we got a yes. And that never happens. And as she tells it, she, you know, read the story when she's first few pages gets to the story about her daughter's birth and subsequent events. She was like, I was a mess, and I was in. So we were so thrilled to get her because she's the perfect embodiment of that character, just quiet strength and calm. And Jeremy was actually, we have to thank her for that. It was a very hard role to cast in the sense of who could that be, and also who's willing to play a supporting actor to a strong female lead movie. And Amy actually loved working with him on wait, I'm not blinking on it.
Don't ask us, we're just
moving. No. American Hustle. Thank you. American Hustle. And she suggested him, and we were like, of course it's him. And he's so such a pleasure to watch in the movie because he's so quiet and in the background, and he has really great levity too, but he just kind of sneaks up on you, and you just remember what an incredible actor he is. And it was a dream to get Forrest Whitaker as well. We needed a rock, a real sort of presence in the movie who could play a military leader, and he did a lot with a small role.
How much did your beliefs or not beliefs in aliens influence them? Like, because you see them, like, what? It looked like a big hand.
You know, I don't believe it was belief or not belief, but I think as fans of the genre, we always felt that many films, it's a disappointment. You go in, everyone always waits to show you, which is smart because you don't want to see it in the first minute. But when you finally see it, even with the advances of CGI, they sometimes just feel cartoonish and they don't feel real. And the thing that we really wanted to work hard on, this is really, we owe this to Denis. And we had great concept artists, but Denis really wanted something with soul and weight. You know, he referenced a lot whales and elephants, something with wisdom, something that you couldn't quite make out. And so that was really our goal. And it has to be a character. She forms a bond with the alien. It has to feel like it's there.
You spoke about there was like 20 drafts. What was the toughest sequence or the sequence that changed the most from the initial draft to the final product?
That's an excellent question.
Thank you.
I think one of the harder scenes to get right was when she was in the ship. That was something that we really had to, again, without giving anything away, there was a version of too much information and too little. And initially, we went with too little, thinking, oh, it's going to be clear at this point. And we had way too little. So that we had to massage that and make sure we didn't over-inform the audience where we hit them over the head, but we wanted the reveal to creep up on them. So that sequence was really tricky. You're so polite, you guys.
We're all friends. This is a cool table. So you're very, I noticed you're being very careful not revealing the twist. How hard is that? Because I know, like, even looking at the trailer, like, we're like, what's going on before seeing the movie, of course. Can you talk a little bit about how you guys maintain the secrecy?
It's actually been easy. The reviewers have been phenomenal. I think everyone doesn't want to rob people of what that is. We want to hint at it a bit. We haven't yet. We're all very tempted to do it because we do want people to know, because I think people love those types of movies where there's, because I think a movie stands on its own, but that's an added element that I think people will talk about for a long time. So it is not easy to not blurt it out in environments like this where I have to catch myself and pull back. But I think it's all a shared desire for all of us, the producers, the makers of the film, Denis, the writer, you all, to let everyone have the same enjoyment and experience with it.
If somebody says that this is this generation's close encounters of the third kind, would you find that a flattering compliment or an unfair comparison?
I would hug them. I would be very happy. We'd be thrilled. We did reference it a lot. That's a brilliant film, and you can never compare yourself to it, but you can aspire to be close to it.
We were talking all before the roundtable started about if we knew our lives, how it would all play out. If you knew your life, how it would all play out, would you make the same decisions? Or?
I actually, it's one of the things that always compelled me about the movie, because I think about that all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, if I went to this college, would I have ended up in the same career, and would I have made the choices? And even though you have things go your way in life, sometimes they don't. I think about it all the time, and yeah, I'd like to think I would keep everything the same. I think it's fascinating. I think we are all guilty. I'm not guilty. It's a natural thing to think, well, what if I didn't do this? What if I had gone over, taken a year off of college? Or, I find it ultimately compelling. I will always ask that question of myself.
Last question, you guys. Well, the language is circular. Mm-hmm. The timeline in this is circular. Was that an intentional...
Yes. Yes, it was something we really thematically always wanted, and I have to give a ton of credit to Eric Heiser, who devised the language being circular. In the story, it's not circular, but he came up with that theme, and he actually, in all the scripts, he had a rudimentary drawing of what the logograms looked like. They were a little bit more techie, but it was the idea that Denis and our amazing production designer, Patrice Vermette, worked off of. And we love that idea, and that you know, there's moments where you see the girl with the stick in the water, and it's kind of circular. It's throughout, and it really connected everything in the movie.
Next up, we have screenwriter Eric Heiser.
Can you talk a little bit about how this project came to you and how you approached adapting it to the screen?
Certainly, absolutely. I've been a fervent fan of Ted Chiang's work for a number of years. I found a short story of his called Understand on an online zine that a friend of mine sent. And I loved it so much, I was like, wow, what else has this guy done? And I found the collection of short stories on Amazon, bought it, and showed up, you know, 2 days later. And I sat down and thinking, I'm just going to read the first story. And then 5 hours later, you know, I'm like, I just chewed right through it. And I got to Story of Your Life, and that's the one that I had to stop and put it down and go out and, like, hug my wife. And, like, and just, like, I had such a profound emotional effect on me. And I then realized this is what I wanted to share with an audience. Not really how cinematic it was or really the lack thereof, but really how this made me feel. And if there's a way I can gently lift it from this source material and find a way to translate that to film, then I would be a lucky dog. And then it wasn't until I spent two years from one producer meeting to the next, anytime they asked if there was a piece of source material I wanted, and I would say this, and, you know, it said it's a short story, it's the sci-fi story I've been wanting to make all my life. And they would ask, well, what's it about, you know? And I'd get into, well, it's a female lead, it's a non-franchise movie, deals with the linguistic relativity, and their eyes would gloss over. Like, I lost them completely. And they're like, here's the water, get out. And I was nearly giving up on that. I nearly given up that when I sat down with Dan Levine and Dan Cohen at 21 Laps, and they had read the script for a drama that I just finished directing called Hours. And they were very excited about finding something that was non-horror for me to do, because it's the one thing I kept saying was, like, I didn't want to do one thing. I'd been doing one thing, and I had only written one horror script out of 13 when I got in, and I'm desperate to try and do something that's emotional and sci-fi. And they're like, we love it, we'll take a look at it. I did not expect to get a call back, but Dan Levine called on Monday, and he's like, this is phenomenal. This is absolutely great. You haven't shared this with anybody else, have you? And I'm like, well, for 2 years now. and he just went pale. And he was like, well, whatever, we're doing it. And we were off to the races. So we got a shopping agreement, which is a very easy thing to do in order to just get, like, 90 days, run around, and pitch out our version of the movie. Here's the story. Here's how I envisioned the film to be. And we went to all the studios, and all the studios said, no, not at all. You know, we got some interesting qualifiers at that time. Plenty of passes were like, well, we'd consider making it if you change the lead to a man. You know, if you make it a standard invasion movie and, you know, someone punches an alien at the end of it, that's nice. We had somebody else who, like, just fundamentally misunderstood the story, and they're like, well, if you can get rid of the flashbacks, then you have yourself a good movie. And I was like, I can't believe this. No! And the Dans and I were just bemoaning that, and so usually that's the end of it. Like, when you pitch an idea to the buyers and the buyers say no, that's the end of the road. But I called them the next day and I said, this is in my bones. I am so in love with the character and the story. I just want to get a chance to write it. I'm going to do this on spec. Let's just quietly get the rights to it, and I'll write it on spec, and you guys can nurture this with me and help me along the process. And they were great shepherds in that regard. Of course, all my reps at the time were like, what? No. Everyone said no. You're wasting your time. You're literally wasting your time, Eric. And I was really stubborn. and said, I have to do this anyway. And I'm no longer with those reps. but no, okay, at any rate, we got the script completed, and we sent that out about a year later, and all the studios passed again. But the independent financiers, like the Aaron Ryder and David Lindy's of the group, were passionate about it, and they got very excited. And we had a very, like, a featherweight bidding war is what I would call it, you know, like, where, among the people that really understood the material and connected with it, they were passionate about it. And I think at one point in time, Love, Bear, and Filmation found out that they were both in the mix, and they sort of Voltron together in order to win and make it happen. And therefore, we had ourselves a movie with backing, and, you know, I had the kind of relationship to everybody in the process that I'd been asking for years and years in other genres, where I was also an exec producer and could help shepherd this thing all the way to the end. And there was a little bit more development process, and then a lot of pining and just looking at a photo of Denis and just hoping someday. He read the short story and connected with it many, many moons ago, and made it very clear, I don't know how this is a film. How do you make this a film? I don't understand. And then finally we got the script to him, and he read it and sat down with me. That is, I think you've heard this before, but it's just such a strange experience with me and Denis, in that every other time I've sat down with the director, it's like a half-hour meeting, and I'm putting my kid in their car, and they just drive off, you know. And I like wave, and that's the end of it. I don't know what happens next. And then here, it was a coffee meeting that lasted for like 90 minutes, and we talked about philosophy and politics and Snell's Law and, you know, all sorts of things. And then at the end of it, he's like, "It's very nice. I like this. Let's do this next week." And I went, "What? What is going on? All right, sure." And then we did that like six more times, where it was a little two-person podcast, me and Denis, a little coffee shop in Westwood. And we kept doing that until finally I got the announcement that, well, he's on board now full-time. And he called me directly and he says, "All right, Eric, now we are married." And I understood immediately how he works with writers and why it took so long. And sure enough, he meant it. Like, even though he went off and he had to shoot Sicario first, he and I still kept in touch. And then when he put his focus on this, I had to atone for everything. If there's a question he had, so often you see someone who adopts a script like a child, and then they interpret subtext in every scene. They read their own into whatever the description or narrative dialogue is, and they pay attention to the things they want to, and they ignore the rest. And you can still get phenomenal movies out of that, even if it's not the original intent. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But Denis just asks questions every page of, like, you know, what is this? Why is this? What is this here? You know, the way that a little kid asks you about, like, every kind of, why? Like, it's that, but in a most, like, you know, French-Canadian artistic way, he went that. And if I didn't have an answer, if I was like, "Oh, I don't know," he's like, "Great, cut." Which rightfully should. Like, you know, like, I totally get it. But it was phenomenal. And, you know, I found myself even on set, like, writing dialogue for anchor persons on the TV screens in the background. And that was a really long answer, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Great story.
Persistence, man. I love it.
Well, thank you for sticking to your guns and proving that something different is can be a very good thing.
Thank you.
How did the whole rights thing come about with Ted? Was that a huge, arduous process? How do you keep your hopes up, like, I am going to get these rights? Mm-hmm.
It was really scary. Mm-hmm. And then it was all right. Mm-hmm. So we had the shopping agreement for the pitch, which was a very easy thing that didn't require much thinking on either party. But then when it didn't sell, so we bombed out on that, and then we approached again to say we want the full option for at least a year to the story, and he's going to write it on spec. Then that raised some alarms, and I've done 100 pitches to 100 different execs. I've had some horrible stories that I will tell you at another time. And pitching to a speakerphone, the author who I'm totally in love with, and saying, I'm going to borrow the keys to your car, and I'm going to come back with some aftermarket changes, and please don't hate me. It was like a nearly an hour-long pitch at the end of it. Ted is prone to these pregnant pauses, and he could go Emperor of Rome. Like, you never know which way he's going to go with him. And said he was that nerve-wracking for us until he said, I think this will work. All right, let's do this. And he gave us the year. I started writing that night, like immediately. I was like, thank God. Mm-hmm. Boom, back to the computer. Off I went. And emailed him throughout the process. Sometimes there would go months would go by because really there was nothing going on with it, or I had to do a lot of work to help pay the rent while I was doing the sound spec. And then he would help keep me honest about, like, well, this science is actually this, or this person wouldn't say that word, or this, that, and the other. It's all very important to me because the authenticity is such an integral part of the story. And we didn't have trouble throughout. And in fact, nobody else had actually come to him for rights to any of the stories. Like, we were the first in legit business. I think somebody who was outside of the business, like an amateur writer, was like, hey, can I get such and so a story? And but we were the actual, he could find us on IMDb. Like, oh, yeah. This is a thing. All right.
You're legit.
And now, of course, I think, like, as it should be, he's got all sorts of comers.
Having directed yourself, does that change how you write movies now?
It does. It does. Yeah, I can't let myself get away with stuff that I know is unfilmable.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I do, I'll put a marker in it on the script so that it's for the reader only. And when I go back in and, it's going to be going to a director, I will tell people ahead of time I need to do some slight changes. And they'll be like, what? What are you talking about? And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense to a director.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's that. I keep that in mind. I don't worry about budget though, mm-hmm. at least not early on. I discovered that if you start worrying about budget, then you'll get half of whatever you were trying to worry about. Like, so you're constantly like working yourself into a corner. So you shoot for the stars and then mm-hmm. see what you get.
Dan was saying that when you guys came to talk about the cast, you both had Amy in mind.
Yes, I had her on a note card.
Yeah.
Like, I pitched with note cards, okay? And so I print them out on a little color printer, and it's all like, you got to get as visual as possible, because some of these execs, it's a generalization, yes, but like, they're just like, they just can't keep up. And like, if you give them something pretty to look at, like Amy Adams, like, I had her for Louise,
Was it something during scripting that you had in mind, or was it like...
No, that was just in trying to, like, sell who these characters were in the film, and that was before I even started writing the script on spec. This was trying to pitch it out and finding a home for it. I put down the reason it was Amy Adams. Colonel Lover was Jeffrey Wright. I don't remember what I have for Ian. But the fact that we got Amy is the biggest wish fulfillment for me ever, like that. It's just crazy. I don't even know if she believes me fully. Like, when I talk about that, she's like, yeah, I'm sure.
Find the note card.
Yeah, I'm gonna find the note card.
This was the note card.
Yes, it is.
This is what
can you sign this?
Obviously, you have a really great human story at the core of the film, mm-hmm. but I imagine that you would also have to do a lot of technical research when it came to the linguistics.
Yeah.
Like, what was that process?
Some of that was in the story. You know, again, Ted had done some lifting for me on that. I went and did some research on my own and spoke to a linguistics expert and did as much reading as possible. And I thought I did a whole lot and then found out that I had only enough to make me dangerous. Because there's a giant gulf between me and these people. The best I could do was hope that I captured the essence of what they did.
Last question, you guys.
And the producer said earlier that this is about whether you want to have loved and lost, to not do that at all. If you already know your life already at that time, how it would play out. Is that part of the theme, or that you already had in mind coming into the whole? I mean, was it already in the short story? Or
The short story was far more rigid about determinism.
Okay.
And Ted's message within the short story was to embrace the inevitable.
Okay.
And it didn't really give Louise choice in the matter, really. And it just let her be at home with that. And I got very rebellious, and I'm like, well, Ted, that's not going to work for me in the film. Sorry. I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to change the core of this. And... he's been game. If he secretly hates me on some form, like, I can't believe he changed it. So be it. But I wanted to make it a profound statement that she still chose to have mm-hmm. Hannah, despite knowing what was going to happen in her life. And it's a very small moment in the film, but it means so much to me. And it's when she talks about how Hannah is unstoppable because of her poetry and her swimming trophies and all of that. She's talking about Hannah's contribution to the world and how that affects other people. And the fact that if she chooses not to have Hannah, will the world be a lesser place? Mm-hmm. Like, how many people will she have, like not been able to affect? So it's not a selfish thing, really. Mm-hmm. It's very much of a, you know, I need to make sure that this contribution exists.
Now we have producer David Lind.
What's going on?
We're just talking about a really awesome film.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Did you like the movie?
That's a foregone conclusion.
It's very profound, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so.
So Eric was telling us you're one of the independent producers that came aboard.
Uh-huh.
So what was it that you saw in his script that you thought, we need to make this movie, why hasn't anybody done it yet?
Well, I'm, you know, as a producer or executive or the many hats that I've worn in my life, I'm very interested in distinction, right? And I think today... I'm especially interested in what makes things distinct because I think audiences demand it, right? And I don't think audiences, with the exceptions of like, you know, Marvel and Star Wars and these big things that are distinct within their own genre, so to speak, I think that audiences absolutely demand to know what is it that's going to be distinct for me, and so I had never read, and I love genre. I love all sorts of genre filmmaking, but I'd never seen a film that was so delicate and at the same time so big, right? And was talking about was combining the power of a science fiction movie with the intimacy of a film that's about relationships. And when I read it, I was just saying earlier that it was one of those few cases where you're like, oh yeah, we're doing this, no doubt about it. So it was like, and we'll grab onto Eric's feet and follow him around until he agrees to it. But
Eric was talking about how certain execs wanted to change so many of the things that made the film great. I guess from the perspective of producer, like, what's up with those people? Like, why do you think they're so close-minded as to...
to not take those risks.
Yeah. I mean, because obviously it worked out brilliantly. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I don't know how much you guys know about me, but I've been in both an executive... I've been in those shoes before. I've been an executive, and yeah. I've been a producer, and I've been an entrepreneur, I guess, is the other thing that I've been. But, look... things like that don't bother me so much, right? Because I don't have to be the writer, you know? but... I think that, you know, you can't do your job well unless you're able and willing to express an opinion, right? And opinions get expressed through experience, right? And so one of the things about movies being successful is that they find their place in the world, right? And so I've always found that, you know, especially with movies as distinct as this, especially with movies with filmmakers like a Denis or a Cuaron or an Ang Lee or people like that, right, you have to find the right home, right? And part of the process of finding the right home is dialogue and conversation, right? And the reality of the matter is not everybody's going to see the benefit of every single movie. And I don't mean to be simplistic about it. And so what you do is you work your way to find the place where people understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And in the world of independent films, that's probably harder, you know, sometimes. But I think that's kind of my attitude towards it is people don't get it, they don't get it, right? And then I don't want to be in business with them, right? And ultimately we found the people who did get it, you know, and you know, the combination. And it's a film that's got... It's Paramount is doing, you know, Paramount has been a great partner domestically. Sony has a bunch of international territories, and then we have a couple of very big independent distributors as well. And it's kind of a hybrid, but it's an exciting hybrid of people who have different perspectives who have all decided that they wanted to be part of the movie. It's a studio independent something.
Is that
a good sign when so many studios want to get involved in the story, in a production or a movie. You know, you mentioned Sony, Paramount. So. It's a good sign.
I think it's an indication of the quality of the piece, right? And also the other thing about it is, you know, going back to what you were saying is that this film, you know, really, really happy you guys all like it, you know, this film is an independent movie, right? It found its voice as an independent movie. It was not made for $150 million, right? And it would not have been made for $150 million, right? And so it found its voice as an independent movie, and it was then that the distributors, that we found the right distributors, because they understood what Denis, the voice that Denis wanted to bring to the material. And that required more of an independent kind of construct or building it. So, and it is exciting. I mean, look, it's like, you know, I've run independent companies, I've, you know, run studios, I've done all sorts of things, but there are real advantages to being in business with studios when you're talking about films like this. And we're excited about our partners.
How did the cast come aboard? Because you have such a great ensemble of players here. Like, it seemed like you had your pick to choose from. But maybe that's just not the case.
No. Amy was an absolute, right? I don't think that there was... I mean, can you imagine an actress? It's hard to imagine an actress who is going to be a mother to be and a mother at the same time, right? A linguist, and somebody who's prepared to assume unbelievable responsibility, mm-hmm. right? And so that balance of delicacy of performance, you know. Who wouldn't want Amy Adams in that role? And everybody, it was, I don't even think there was anybody ever really discussed, and I'd have to think back, you know, a year and a half or 2 years, but it was always, well, if Amy Adams wants to do it, we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And she did want to do it. And she had wanted to work with Denis, and Denis had wanted to work with her, so it was a very good, it was sort of it was providence, I think. In the case of Jeremy, we also didn't. We were incredibly lucky, in retrospect. We didn't offer to anybody else other than Jeremy as well. And he and Jeremy and Amy, as you may know, are both friends, and are our friends. And it was the same finding the same kind of balance, right? You had to find two people who were good enough actors, right, to start in one place and end up in a very different place, and you would believe that. But the same thing is with Jeremy, right? You had to find somebody whose intellect you believed in, right? But who also you believe was prepared to assume responsibility, right? Who was willing to look at something really foreboding almost and scary. And was willing to say, okay, I'm willing, along with this amazing woman, I'm willing to assume responsibility. And he was great about that. And then regarding, you know, I mean, on the Forrest, you know, if Forrest Whitaker is going to play a role in your movie, then I don't honestly think you say no.
Michael Stuhlbarg is great, too.
He's fantastic, yeah.
Eric said that the script went over like 20 different drafts before you reached the final one. Uh-huh. Can you tell us about how, as a producer, along the way, you kind of shepherded this story to make it, you know, more identifiable for audiences? Because it has a lot of really big scientific ideas as well, uh-huh. in it, and the linguistics.
Well, I think that the most delicate work was done when Denis came on. Right, and I will say that it's always a really good sign when a filmmaker and a writer are working very closely together and are not necessarily talking through producers. So I would say they were talking with the producers, right? And to me, the most valuable work that was done during that period was really landing. The believability of Amy's experience, right? Because you're asking the audience to really be thoughtful, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a delicate ask. And the ability to sort of, I think that they did a really terrific amount of work of, you're never in a position in this movie, in my opinion, right? In this position where you fall out of believability, right? Which happens in movies. You're like, well, you know, that couldn't have happened, right? So you're asking them to embrace a very, very big idea, right? That is actually not going to really reveal itself to the end of the movie, right? And that was the kind of making sure that that would really happen was a lot of the work that was happening towards the end, and that was, to me, the most kind of personally valuable.
Now we sci-fi fans always look for the next great sci-fi. I think this is it. Definitely one of them.
Oh, thank you.
Award season's coming up. Is Paramount pushing this as a potential contender? And what do you think? What do you think the chances are?
Oh, I don't know. I've been incredibly fortunate. Somebody was telling me the other day that I've been involved with films that have been nominated for over 80 Academy Awards in many, many different. And I was incredibly lucky. I'm now running participant media, and literally 3 months after I get the job, Spotlight won Best Picture, so it was very exciting. Absolutely, Paramount's being incredibly supportive, first of all, and very intuitive and very smart about the film's presentation. I would like to believe, what I see, I see 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, I see, going to screenings and people applauding, but also crying, right? And
so many tears.
and to me, that's incredibly rewarding. And so what you want is, all that you can ask for is that the Academy responds to the movie in the way that you hoped and that you intended. And so what I'm seeing is that they are, right? And that's what I'm feeling. And I think also... I guess just recognizing the film's real strengths, right? And those real strengths are personified by Denis and by Amy and by Jeremy and by Bradford and Patrice and all the people who've done amazing work on it, right? Knock on wood.
You've worked with a lot of filmmakers who have a very strong visual sense. Mm-hmm. As a producer, is that sort of a gamble that you just have to like trust this picture with a person who has the voice like completely thought out in their head when you come back and see dailies and you may not?
I made a decision a long time ago, which is the tack that what interested me was direction. Mm-hmm. Right? And by the way, I've made plenty of mistakes, there's no doubt about that. And it comes back from when I moved to New York in 1983, and it was like, I tell this story all the time, which is like literally 2 weeks after I moved to New York, I was in a bar and Jim Jarmusch was sitting next to me in the bar. I was like, oh my God. Jarmusch. And then I was 23 years old.
Yeah.
And then I remember being in a bodega in on the Upper West Side, and Joel and Ethan Coen walked in, and I was like, oh my God, Joel, and I've gotten to work with both of them, mm-hmm. right, or all three of them, and so I just threw in with the director's perspective, if this is of any interest, and I trace it to, mm-hmm. I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, my dad was a professor, and we lived a block from the University of Oregon campus, and in those days, you had... faculty brats were treated the same as students. So we had student ID cards and things like that. And so, rains a lot in Eugene, and it's, not a lot to do. And so we would always go to the movies on the weekends with my parents. And so, they're very interested in culture, and they believe culture is really, really important, which actually relates to one of the reasons I made the movie. But so we would go see like Woody Allen movies, and we would go see Charlie Chaplin movies. And my parents are both academics, and so they were not interested in going to see Planet of the Apes. Right? They were interested in going to see Woody Allen or the next French film or things like that, and we would have these free passes. And that's always sort of like... I, I, I caught that bug at a pretty young age.
Mm-hmm. One last quick question.
With such an exciting career, is there any, in all the roles you've, you know, worked in, is there anything you still aspire to do? Or something, a big...
Change the world. No, what I aspire to do? Look, I was just telling somebody that I'm an optimist at heart, right? And what do I aspire to do? Well, right now, you know, what I aspire to do is to make Participant as successful as possible and work with extremely good people. And with any luck, you know, we'll get to make movies with Dan and Aaron and Denis and all these people. And that's...
Lastly, we have producer Aaron Ryder.
How's everybody?
Hi.
Good.
Congratulations
on the movie.
Thank you. Hi. Yeah, that's how are you? I guess.
Okay.
All right. Holding up all right?
Yeah.
Love
we
the film.
We're talking about a movie we all genuinely love.
Yeah.
Yeah?
That really helps.
Yes.
That's good. Yeah. Arrival, right?
Of course.
Well, your filmography is no stranger to these really great, memorable thrillers like Donnie Darko, Memento. So where do you think Arrival kind of fits into that story lineage?
Wow. You know, Arrival is one of the most exciting films I've ever been involved with, to be honest with you. Here's what's exciting about it. It feels like perfect for right now. You know, it's like a movie about communication in an era where it's complicated right now in a complicated world about communication, miscommunication, and misinterpretation. That's perfect for right now. And like any good science fiction, it should, like, you know, be a reflection of what's happening in society. And I feel like, when we read the script and got involved with it, it just felt very timely. And then once you start talking to Denis about how he wants to do it, then it gets really exciting. And then you get kind of excited about making the whole thing, because it can be a slog when you're putting these things together. And this was one day we all kind of earmarked as, like, special.
When you first got heard of this going around town and hearing Eric's pitch and reading his script, what were your thoughts on it? Were you like, why hasn't this been made yet? Or did you understand the reasons why it hadn't been made?
Really, it was like, why hadn't Ted Chiang's, any of his stories been made into a film yet? That was my bigger surprise. And I'll be honest with you, Dan Levine, who you met earlier, that very short producer. He and Dan Cohen at 21 Laughs did a lot of the heavy lifting in developing the story, developing the script. And so it came to Film Nation at a slightly later step in the process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about some great science fiction films from the past, you think of Close Encounters or, like, Contact or Alien, Blade Runner. There was... It's hard standing in the shadow of these great films, but then you haven't felt or seen a science fiction film that had an emotional component to it in quite some time. Mm-hmm. That was kind of exciting to us. And then what Denis brought to it was this sense of realism, this texture, this grittiness to it, that just really, if he made it very real, it was going to be very relatable, and it felt grounded. And that approach is applied through every aspect of the movie, whether it be casting, the design of it, the look of it, the photography, it just kind of had that opportunity to it. So when you see a script that's got big ideas and you can kind of put it all through a female protagonist, which was also wildly exciting for us, and then it had that sort of emotional component to it, you feel kind of lucky that it hopped onto your desk.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a testament to Ted Chiang. That's a smart fella right there.
Yeah.
And then to take a short story like that one, which is relatively dense in its ideas and big, not a difficult story to read, I'm just saying dense with big ideas, to be able to transpose that into a screenplay,
mm-hmm.
it also a testament to the talent of Eric, because it shows his ability of not only a great writer, but he's looking through he's a filmmaker too, and he, without that experience behind him, I don't think we'd have gotten where we got. Good question, though.
Thank you.
People seem to be reacting really positively to this movie. I think you would be hard-pressed to find anybody seeing the whole movie and saying, like, that was great, oh, except they should have changed the fact that it was a female.
Just right. Somebody's got to say.
So given that would be such a small, small, minor percentage of viewing audiences, hopefully, why does there seem to be this resistance, I guess, amongst studios? To actually thrust a female into, like, a lead in this type of film?
I think that it's changing a little bit. You know, I think the paradigm of action stars, male action stars, and what movies should be, it's changing. This isn't your typical studio movie, but it's being distributed by students, being distributed wide. And I believe that because of the population of really great television, which is happening, cable right now, and with technology advancing the way it is, I think people's minds are open a little bit more. And again, going back to like great television, people are watching better and better, higher quality pieces of entertainment right now. And the bar's been raised. And it's opening up doors, I think, in people's minds. And those tropes that we used to rely on of like an action film has to be this and it's got to star this guy, that's not always the case. And I think that now, hopefully, we're going to prove that you can have a movie that has big ideas and emotion to it and be a science fiction film and have a female lead to it. There's no reason that audiences shouldn't accept that because it has all the components that make a good film.
Has television caused a little bit of an obstacle as well as far as character development is concerned? Because you have 2 hours for us to care about two or three characters, but television has like 20 hours or two seasons, you know, years.
I suppose, but I think that, you know, in actuality, I think TV is more confining in the way they have to tell a story. There's a certain rhythm and cadence that you have to have in telling a story on TV because you have a very specific amount of time every day or every episode to tell it. You're also on TV, you're relying on one trick that we've been doing for 75 years now, which is at just the right moment, you're arresting the narrative and stopping and getting people to come back. Right? So it's always relying on that. And film doesn't have that. What film has is a more free-flowing structure to it often, as is the case with what we're doing. And it gives you the ability to tell things at maybe a slightly more deliberate pace. So it's not the same sort of structure where you have to have a commercial break or even just hit the 48-minute mark as you have on most TV things. So I still believe that film is a more free medium. But that said, there's some phenomenal television happening, some really great ideas and big ideas out there. It's making us all work a little harder. Gone are the days of just being able to make an okay movie. You got to be making really good films, and I kind of love that. Audiences deserve it.
The heptapods have their languages, logograms and semigrams. Our culture now has GIFs and emojis and Vine videos to express how we're feeling. Do you think we're progressing or do you think we're regressing? Or maybe a little bit of both?
Absolutely both. you know, it's funny. Technology is advancing at such a rate. You wouldn't have understood, you know, what a Vine was 3 years ago, mm-hmm. much less 10 years ago. You know, it's... The funny thing is, I was walking through an airport the other day, and 100% of the people were looking at their hand in their phone. And I thought, oh my God, if you went back 10 years and saw that, you'd be like, what the hell is everybody doing looking at their hands? It's just, it's advancing to such a quick degree. And there's no way of telling what's going to happen 3 to 5 years from now, because it's moving at such velocity. So, you know, the way they communicate, I believe, is rudimentary. But there's complexity in that, right? And if you think about how we're communicating right now, the things that we're talking about, we are now with emojis. We're sending smiley faces to people as a way of communicating our ideas. That's definitely not a step forward.
To piggyback off that, you know, somebody told me that if we as humanity can learn better to communicate with each other, we would not have half the conflicts that we have today in the world. That's what... Because that's the core of the problem. We it's difficult for us to understand each other, and we assume the worst of the other.
And that's like a big part of the movie too.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. The worst of.
Yeah. I like that part of the movie. So you know the I think China and Sudan were already about hostile. You know. So was that part of a conscious decision in the part of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said earlier, like you know, great science fiction should always be kind of reflecting what's happening in the world. Mm. And it is a complicated time. It's a very divisive time. And we are constantly miscommunicating and misunderstanding people around us, and we're also afraid of people. I mean, that was a very big theme in this, of like, here they come, they're perceived as invaders or intruders by a good portion of the population. And I think if that were to happen today, like, it's not just if aliens came from outer space to our planet, it's if people come from other places of the world that we don't understand into our country, we get scared about that. It's in the news every day as refugees are trying to find a home. We're all, Europe's nervous about it, and the United States is certainly nervous about it. And instead of embracing that, I think we get scared about that. And that theme is here, it's reflected in this. You know, the world, when we shot this more than a year ago, we didn't have exactly what was going on in the world as we do today. Mm-hmm. But isn't it amazing how it's kind of timely?
Exactly. That,
to me, that's good science fiction. That's good writing. And the short story was written in 1998.
Oh, wow.
I mean, those themes have been, it's kind of universal in some ways, too. You know, being afraid of aliens, not just the ones from outer space.
Is that why storyline, what would you think, okay, so like storyline in sci-fi would be much more important than the effects, because effects get dated.
Right.
Sure. So then we could talk about.
Well, I think that there's a bit of fatigue too that audiences have with heavy vis effects movies. You know, you're seeing, you know, in Man of Steel, how many buildings got blown up and things fall over. I think after a while, you almost get numb to it. You know, that I enjoyed the movie. I don't mean I'm not picking on it. It's so much that's going on. And so what was important to us was to not have a movie completely reliant on vis effects. Now, granted, we had spaceships and aliens, which don't exist, that we know of. there's a certain amount we have to rely on, but we want it to feel, again, very real. And not rely so much on those, on visual effects, but like real things. And have people, and real issues. So, again, it comes back to the thing that Denis really responded to, is like the ability to make something in a different, a science fiction film with a different texture to it. You know, you look at that photo, almost like you could take that out of a Terrence Malick movie in some ways. You know, there just happens to be a gigantic spaceship in the background. But it's a balance between both, that emotional component, and yet at the same time, it's got to be kind of a cool science fiction film. It's got to have the wonder to it and the scope to it that people expect. It's a challenge that we have that we're very aware of, and I hopefully we succeeded. I think we did.
So just based on your answers here this afternoon, it sounds like you are a fellow science fiction fan. So what were some of the classic stories that you grew up with that maybe influenced your outlook or your creative path?
You know, we talked about Close Encounters earlier. I actually had the opportunity to watch that maybe a year or two ago, like on the big screen. And I forgot just how great that film is, and how it was. It really, you're right there with Richard Dreyfuss and everything that's going on. It's such a well-made film, and it holds up to this day. And it's a completely odd film in some ways. You know, I mean, he leaves his family, and it's kind of like you can't get away with that. So that was a huge influence on all of us, and certainly on me. As far as science fiction goes, and I think Blade Runner, funny enough, Denis shooting the sequel to that's always been one of the great science fiction films out there, because it's ultimately a detective story, and it, you know, it kind of crosses genres a little bit, and I think we do too. And it's just the straight science fiction for me isn't as interesting as the ones that have a little bit of something else to them, like the way Blade Runner crosses a noir detective story. But that's Philip Dick. He's very good at that sort of thing.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
What can we? That's a good question. I'm.
Are you trying to get another rights to another?
We've got a few things. We have a movie coming out called The Founder, with Michael Keaton in January, and that's a good one. And then we're prepping a movie called Life Itself that Dan Fogelman wrote, who This Is Us creator. He wrote one of the most emotional scripts I've ever read in my life. It's a multi-generational story that is unbelievably great, and that'll be probably the next thing we shoot. So we'll sit around this table in a year from now.
Sorry, last question.
when these projects come across your path, what is it that stands out to you the most? Is it a storyteller with a strong vision, or is it just an emotional core that resonates with you?
I think it's finding people, whether it be Denis Villeneuve or Richie Kelly or one of the Nolans or Dan Fogelman, finding people that you sit around a table with when you're talking about making the movie, and you start most of your conversations with, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, and we came up with that ship right there that you're seeing because me, Dan, and Denis were walking through a park and we found a stone and we're like, wouldn't it be cool if you could create something, and we look at it at this angle, it's one thing, and you turn it and it looks completely different, and like you start your conversation like that, and that's like the greatest part of my job, is being able to be a kid and find people that think the same things are cool that you think. And if you get to do that every now and then, you're pretty fucking lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Check out Arrival out in theaters November 11th. Quick reminder that Dysfunctional Podcast is on iTunes. Subscribe by searching Dysfunctional, Thisfunctional. If you don't have iTunes, check out more of my stuff here on audioboom.com/channel/dysfunctional. Check out more entertainment news on dysfunctional.com. Follow me on social media at Dysfunctional on Twitter and Instagram, Dysfunctional LA on Facebook, and Dysfunctional on the Good Shows app and Snapchat.